My guest today is Isidore Barmash, who's reported on retailing issues over the past 20 years. He's currently at the New York Times. In 1985 and 86, he covered the leveraged buyout of Macy's department store by a group of their executives. He chronicles the personal and financial maneuverings in his new book called Macy's for Sale. Now, you may not think a mega-million-dollar leveraged buyout has much to do with you, but if you go into a store that's gone through this financial metamorphosis to buy a tie, say, the silk may not be as fine or it might cost you more just to help pay for the deal. Though customers may suffer from a corporate takeover, there are some who profit. In the Macy's buyout, someone holding, say, 400 shares of Macy's common stock worth about $17,000 would have made about $8,000 on the buyout. But an executive of the company could expect his same $17,000 investment to bring him $1.5 million in a few years when the stock goes public again. I ask Isidore Barmash if a leveraged buyout was a bit like overextending yourself on a huge home mortgage and then paying off the crushing extra burden of debt by selling off a couple of your kids.
Well, a leveraged buyout is a technique where the people who buy a company, usually the management portion of the investing group, puts up very little money, somewhere on the order of 10 to 20%. To buy a company, and they get banks and insurance companies and other big investors to foot the rest of the bill. In a regular merger, much more money is put up front. The difference then is that in a leveraged buyout, there's much more debt and involving junk bonds, which can take as much as 10, 15 years to pay back. So the risk is much greater for the investors than in a regular merger. Plus the fact that in an LBO, there's the really ironical element in that the assets and cash flow of the company being bought are used to cement a merger. Whereas in a regular merger, that's true to a certain extent, but it's less of a burden because much more money is put up front, therefore there's less debt.
What drives a hostile takeover? Why is it called what is the function of a hostile takeover?
Well, a hostile takeover means that some outside company decides to make a play for a company which they deem to have greater value in its assets than the current market share would show. For example, when Robert Campo, the Canadian entrepreneur, decided to take over Federated Department Stores, which includes Bloomingdale's and A&S and Burdine's and so on, he offered at first a very low bid of about $48 a share. Eventually, because there was resistance, wound up paying $73.50 a share. But he knew that the company was worth a lot more. In a lot of companies, you see, there's hidden assets because a lot of the assets are put and kept on the books at a low historical value, whereas later on, and one of the features of LBOs is to divest what they do buy and pay up debt and make money out of the divestitures, you can get a lot more when you start putting properties on the market than you are carrying them on the books. That's the same situation with Macy's. Macy's paid $68 a share, the management group, and the stock was selling in the 40s at the time they proposed the deal, which was in October of 1985. They realized that there was much more implicit value in the company if it would later be expanded or parts of it sold off. And so there's always that reason of exploiting what is a hidden asset, which would have much greater value later.
A hidden asset being, for instance, a piece of property on which a store is resting in a mall?
Right. That's exactly a good example. Sometimes a company will carry a shopping center or a store in a shopping center at a fairly low value in its balance sheet, partly to pay low, because they want to pay lower taxes. But if they decide to sell it, they're certainly going to ask for a lot more than they're carrying that property on the books. Usually it's about 25 to 35% more value than is shown on their books.
What is the force that goes on in a hostile takeover that says that says a company has to accept the offer that comes in? Why can't a company just sort of ignore the phone calls and say, sorry, we aren't interested? I mean, what is the is there any compulsion for a company to respond to a hostile takeover effort?
Yes, there is. The main reason to respond is that the offer is usually well above the current market share, which means that the management of the company and the directors have to consider any offer in the light of benefiting the shareholders.
So this is an obligation then?
Yeah, and in past cases, going back 10 years, for example, where a company didn't respond, the hostile investor walked away without getting the company, management was sued by a bunch of shareholders in class action suits, alleging that the directors had not operated for the benefit of the shareholders. And there are lots of lawyers out there in all the cities who are looking to class action suits, because they generally are settled out of court at a very high fee. And they, of course, like that. So there's that ever-present threat that if I want to buy your company and you don't respond, your shareholders are going to sue the hell out of me later.
Ironically, because of a takeover, it's often the of a leveraged buyout, it's often the shareholders who are hurt the most, though.
That's the irony of it. And there are a lot of shareholders who are unhappy about it. You can say, well, they got $20 a share or $30 a share more than the stock was worth at the time. But the fact is that not everybody wants to have a one-shot cash-in. They want to keep the shares. It's an extra form of security.
Plus it'll pay the dividends, and
plus
then they'll have to pay
taxes
on what comes in.
And the stock can always rise in value.
And, of course, it seems the scale of profit that can be made is much higher for those on the inside of a leveraged buyout. For instance, in your example at Macy's, a $70,000 investment by one of the 350 of the management group decided to be in could net them, after a few years, $3.5 to $4 million, or a $17,000 investment, $1.5 million. I mean, that seems like a far better return than a shareholder would ever see for similar amounts.
No question about it. The Macy Buying Group only put in $17.5 million to reap an eventual $200 million plus.
What kind of workload do people have once they take on all this enormous amount of debt, say, in the Macy's buyout?
They work like hell. They put in longer hours, weekends, nights. The whole emphasis of their job changes from planning new strategy, bringing in new merchandise, to doing everything they can to enhance profit. And it's usually done by cutting expenses. You can have a 5% increase in sales, but if you cut your expenses 10 and 15%, i.e. by lopping off people, lopping off sales clerks, cutting down on various services, your sales can produce a heck of a bigger profit.
So it seems that the focus of doing business after one of these leveraged buyouts changes from, say, selling shirts and coats and ties to that of purely paying off your debt.
Right. A lot of times, too, it causes the management, the buyout group, to take their eye off the ball, and competition closes in on them. And increasingly, there's been a great criticism of these LBO companies. Macy's, for example, has had a very rough year. They don't give out very much, but they have had considerable problems with their many private labels. Customers seem to be becoming less enthralled with store labels, but more going back more to national brands because these brands have more credibility. Private label goods, unfortunately, are very expensive. And that's another thing that happens. These stores increase their markups as they, in other words, raise prices as they pursue the payoff of debt. And that hurts their business because customers are pretty sharp today. They know what a shirt should cost or a dress or a scarf.
I was startled to see that one of the ways that the Macy's buyout was financed was through an insurance company that apparently knew the management wanted the money badly enough so that they're now making a 28% return on their money, plus charging an override on every single sale made.
Yeah, that kind of shocked me when I found out about it. I think it's really one of the most revealing things of all about this Macy for sale business, in that everybody who got involved was making an exorbitant, getting an exorbitant return. And that was as much for the individual as it was for the big company. But that was a good example. I was glad to find out about it. And it's very authentic. I got it from inside the company, the insurance company.
Well, next time my insurance rates go up, I'll think about that.
Good luck.
What are the moral issues that you see raised in this? We see a lot in the press about people such as Ivan Boesky being sent off to the slammer, Drexel Burnham Lambert, a brokerage house that's dealt a lot in junk bonds, being chased by the Racketeering Act. What's happening to American business? Is there just so much money flowing and so many people trying to get their fingers on it that?
Yeah, there's an awful lot of money available from Wall Street and the banks and insurance companies and pension funds. This kind of money is being dangled at lots of interesting possible buyouts. You ask about moral issues. There's a very simple moral issue in which I get into in my book, and that is that I raise the question of whether a chief executive officer who was extremely well paid and his top team, who are extremely well paid, have the right with one hand to operate the company and with the other hand to plan, to take it over. You can't wear two hats. If you are attacked and you see a possibility of benefiting the stockholder by making a better offer or getting a white knight to make a better offer, that's one thing. But in a case where the LBO is self-starting in terms of the management, seems to me that the CEO has not been playing it straight. He's been planning to take over a company that's treated him very well and for which there was no threat and no need. Now, there is another issue here, too, which is just as important and maybe more far-reaching. All these companies that have gotten involved in LBOs, and Macy's is a good example, have suddenly found that the enormous debt that they've taken on was tougher to pay than they thought. And so their activities have been diverted more to being to pay that debt then they have been directed at operating a good company, and it's been a very big diversion or distraction of attention away from the real job to the job of paying off your debt. So the question again is, what is the value of an LBO to society? And more you're hearing in Congress and you're hearing it from businessmen, mergers and their special form, the LBOs, do not really help. Those who advocate them say, well, a company that's strong won't be taken over. On the other hand, while there are examples of strong companies being taken over, mergers do not really help a gross national product. They don't result in giving customers better prices. They do result in less employment because in every merger there is a reduction of force, sometimes amounting to as much as 25%. And there doesn't seem to be any social or economic benefit to American society. And that's a very big moral issue. I think eventually the government is going to have to step in and do something on junk bonds, something which, of course, would affect the incidence of LBOs. And more, there's a great disaffection with this sort of thing.
What do these CEOs and other financial people see when you come around to ask them questions, raise some of these issues? How do they treat you as a member of the press?
Well, with great carefulness and wariness. I've been a business writer all my life, and it's no easier now to get information. In fact, I think it's tougher because you have more government scrutiny. You have all the insider trading scandals. They treat me as a sort of a friendly adversary, in some cases as an unfriendly adversary. I don't ever accept the fact that these people are my good friends, because one thing I've learned is that, unfortunately, they are a good friend until you write something a little bit nasty, and then suddenly you find a total change in their behavior toward you. But generally, I would say there's a growing adversary relationship between business and the media, and it's natural, I guess. There's more to hide, and there's more risk in speaking out. And that's why the media has to be more aggressive and more investigative, and it's not an easy role.
Well, I was struck by the comment that Ross Johnson made, who was involved in the insider takeover bit of R.J. Nabisco, who said that who many people assumed that he was going to earn $1 billion from his LBO, and people thought that there were only going to be seven people who were going to benefit. And he said, "Hey, look, if I knew that this was all going to be in the newspapers, I'd have said there are going to be 15,000 people." It's like these people almost need public embarrassment in order to get some sort of even keel back on how they're running a business.
That's very true. There's an awful lot that goes on that is not exposed. I think the press and all the media have to be much more militant about it and much more probing. On the other hand, in my work at the New York Times, I'm a repository of a lot of rumors and sometimes from anonymous sources, and I find that a lot of them are simply sour grapes and somebody trying to get another guy in trouble. And you have to check everything out. And most of what I hear I don't print because I find there's no confirmation, no real substance to it. So you have to tread that fine line. You've got to be aggressive, but you also have to be very careful. And it is true that business would prefer not to have unfavorable news exposed. It affects their stock. It affects their reputation. But I think more and more, as the SEC gets tough, they are obligated and are revealing more negative stuff, but not nearly enough.
One of the issues that you raise in your book is about loyalty. The main character that you follow through is the president of Macy's, Ed Finkelstein. And one of the qualities that he looks for in his employees is intense personal loyalty to himself. And he feels betrayed if anyone that he's helped out resigns the company, goes off and works at another organization. Yet the whole leveraged buyout issue seems to raise significant issues of loyalty, like where is loyalty? It almost makes loyalty a commodity, because it seems that the ultimate loyalty that anybody has, after all, then, is going to be to the dollar in these deals.
Well, I think if there's one thing that has emerged from this big merger wave of the last 5 years, and there's been a previous one in the 70s, is the fact that there is there are increasing reasons not to be loyal to your employer. And that's very unfortunate, because the quality of loyalty is tantamount to motivation. But as companies are bought and sold, as pieces of it are sold off, as people lose their jobs after many years, the feeling grows that you cannot rely on the employer, that the employer will do what is right for the company rather than for you. The employer will do what's right for the employer. And as I say, I think that's very unfortunate because it does affect how people perform and it does affect how long they stay. As you know, in Japan, it's the reverse. People stay on a job all their lives, and they simply don't understand why we move around from job to job.
You've been covering these issues for such a long time, a couple of decades. Do you see these leverage buyouts as an aberration, a potential footnote to business history, or is it the end of civilization as we know it?
Oh, no, I think it's an aberration. Mm-hmm. I think that the country is going through a massive recycling of its assets. Companies that have been around a long time are being cut into pieces through acquisition. I think LBOs will finally be clamped down on by the government. I think that junk bonds is going, the whole insider trading thing has hurt credibility of mergers anyway. And I think there'll be some new, I think we'll always have mergers. It's just been part of our history. It's comes in fits and starts, but I think the LBO by its own nature and its controversial methods will eventually be knocked out. Some new form will take over, something a little bit more legitimate, perhaps. And but mergers will always be with us. I'm sorry.
Yeah, sorry. Where do you think the rebellion will come from in changing these practices? Will it come from the public outraged at how much money people are making in these deals, sometimes as much as $200 million a year in bonuses for certain individuals, seeing people like Ivan Boesky sent to the slammer? Or will it be through Congress? Or will it be eventually from banks who decide they don't trust the financial arrangements anymore?
I think it'll come from all those directions. It'll come from public disaffection. Congress is talking more and more about this. And I think it'll come from disenchanted large investors who are very antsy anyway when they see a leveraged buyout delaying payment and sales and earnings not doing so well. Look, they have shareholders too. So I think you have all these forces working together. Don't forget, too, that under the Reagan administration, there's been a very lax enforcement of the Sherman Antitrust Act, which could be brought into play much more as it used to be. So now you have a new president, you have a Democratic Congress. I think you're going to see some real action, and I can't predict that it's going to happen next week, but I think you're going to see a lot of discussion about the morality of these mergers and the risks of junk bonds and high corporate debt. And if it doesn't add anything, it's very difficult to substantiate the benefits of all these mergers and make sense. I mean, you can proselytize, mm-hmm. but everybody will know what it is. It's just a lot of hype.
Your background has been in covering retail business for the New York Times for many years. How did you first become interested in the retail trade?
Well, you know, it's the old story. What determines a career? It's more or less an accident. I studied journalism, and after I came out of the Army in World War II, I looked for a job, and it was very difficult. And the first decent job I was offered was with Fairchild Publications, which publishes Women's Wear Daily, in their Philadelphia bureau, and I joined it, and I've been covering this field all the way as both a writer and an editor for many years. Look, I probably would have preferred to cover sports or politics or foreign affairs, but I must say, in all honesty, that I think it's a very interesting field. It's constantly changing. There are some very interesting people and new people coming up. It's a high-speed track, and every day and every week is a new ball game, and that's really my story.
When you walk into a store to buy a tie, are you able just to do that, or do you always keep your eye out for what's going on, how the cash registers are working, how the clerks are treating you, how the design of the store looks?
You know, you're hitting me where it hurts. I hate to shop. I hate to shop.
You do.
My wife is a great shopper and really knows how to beat the system by shopping so well. I can't stand shopping because I'm very impatient. I feel closed in. When I go into a store, I'm sort of caught between wanting to buy a tie or a pair of socks or a jacket and looking around to see what kind of operation it is. I suppose it's like a railroad guy who or an airline guy who may not like to fly but loves to talk about it and write about it and see what's happening.